Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends to doctors in women's health.
With it being Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, one of the things we did was we did a takeover, a site takeover on Contemporary OBGYN with the ribbon. We did the same for the print issue. And so we definitely, you know, I guess amid the pandemic too, it's this idea of we don't want to leave these other areas unaddressed.
Right. Right.
And from where you sit, we'll kick off there with the first question in general about the cervical cancer rates in the United States. And as I said in the question, the latest information I could find through the CDC mm-hmm. for that 1999 to 2007 period with that slight decline. And I, of course, wanted to get your perspective, you know, from that period when there were 9.7 new cases per 100,000 for that total of 13,752 cases, and then into 2017 with 7.5 new cases per 100,000. And when you hear those numbers as a doctor dedicated to this area of health, what do those numbers mean to you? And can you help put them into perspective?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I guess I am familiar with the what that trajectory has looked like even further back. And so it's hard to not factor in that trajectory, right? And the trajectory, if you go even further back, is that there was a very steep decline from the 1950s and 1960s into the early 2000s. And then we look at this period that you're referring to, where that, you know, frankly, that decline has kind of petered out and, you know, even, and it's almost, you know, starting to look like it's stagnating. And that, you know, I think in some ways, we can see that as an early win, that we had a tremendous impact, you know, in the earlier decades. But I think we can also see it as that there is opportunity here to do better. And, you know, on the global stage,
yes,
there is a lot of talk and excitement around the concept of elimination of cervical cancer. And, you know, we should want to be headed in the same direction and frankly be wanting to lead, right, that charge as a very well-resourced country. We, you know, and we're talking about something that is very preventable, and that's why the global stage is talking about elimination. And so we have the resources, we know what works, and we should be able to be leading the charge towards that. And you know, not so a little bit, you know, the fact that the decline is starting to stagnate, and then, you know, there are different types of cervical cancer. And so there is a one type of cervical cancer that may actually be increasing. And so I think also, you know, understanding some of the nuances in those numbers is important. The other nuance that I think is really important to highlight is that, yes, the rates are declining, and the rates have been declining for all races and ethnicities, but that disparities continue to persist. And that Black women continue to have higher incidence and mortality from cervical cancer. With Latinx women have a higher incidence of cervical cancer. And then, you know, the CDC numbers, for example, are not adjusted for hysterectomy, and hysterectomy is more common, for example, among Black women. And so then the disparity actually becomes more profound.
Yes.
When we look at the numbers adjusted by hysterectomy. And so, you know, so appreciating some of those nuances, and you know, really you know, using this as a moment to recommit ourselves to the things that we know that can work, you know, in eliminating cervical cancer, which is the combination of vaccine and screening, and then managing the abnormal results, especially because cervical cancer is something that we can detect precancerous lesions and intervene before something ever even becomes cancer.
Yes.
And, you know, there are other countries, you know, that, such as Australia, that are, you know, there's some modeling data to show that Australia may be able to achieve elimination by 2035. I mean, that's like, that's in our lifetime.
That's why, well, yeah, that's significant. I mean, right. That's amazing, actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
to even think about that, to achieve that. Has that been a lot due to the vaccine?
Yeah, so they introduced a very strong vaccination program for their adolescents early on. And then they also introduced, a more advanced form of cervical cancer screening based on primary HPV testing several years ago. And, the United States now has guidelines from a few different professional societies that support primary HPV testing, but the adoption of that is going to be slower than, you know, in a country like Australia where it's a national program.
Yes. And it seems like the variances in what we hear, at least how it's changed over even my life, about how often women are supposed to get screening, and the pap smear in conjunction with the HPV combined test. And so do you feel like there's been an inconsistency to the patient population, of the communication of it to the patient population?
Yeah, you know, I think it's challenging. Our guidelines, as you're saying, our guidelines have changed, several times. And I think that's partly reflective of the science changing, right? And that's a good thing. So if we can make our screening more focused and better, ultimately that's a good thing, but it does make things confusing for both clinicians, who are busy and it's hard to stay up to date, and then also for patients and the messaging that they receive. But I think also the adoption of primary HPV testing it's going to take, in a health system such as ours, where things are more fragmented.
Yes.
As opposed to countries where there are these national systems that have national screening protocols and guidelines, and then the safety net, it's more streamlined, pushing out changes.
Yes. So there's it's more consistent.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And then the data is also then consistent. Our surveillance systems and our registries are more limited because of the structure of our healthcare system.
Okay. Let's move to the grant that Yale did receive, that 4-year, $1.8 million grant, from NIH to study the effectiveness of the HPV vaccine. Are you able to give us an update?
Yeah, I don't have a date. We're in the process of looking at that data now as we're nearing the end of the grant. So I don't have updated data at this point, but hopefully, in the next 6 months or so, we should have data. We've been enrolling women, and I think it's going to be an exciting study.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I'll be really interested to see the results of that. And so too, you know, going back to that interview in which you'd said that clinicians need to feel comfortable normalizing the HPV vaccine and really present that vaccine as that cancer prevention tool. Do you feel that that's happening? That that's becoming something that clinicians are more comfortable with?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think that's reflected in the HPV immunization rates. You know, every year it's a slow improvement, but as you know, overall sustained improvement, and you know, the rates among 13 to 17 year olds have increased both in terms of getting that first at least one dose in, but also ultimately, right, our actual goal is in making sure that everyone is up to date and getting all the doses in that they need, which can range from 2 to 3 doses depending on how old they are when they get their first one. So I think that that's really promising. I wish it was faster, you know, because every year that goes by that we're not at 100%, that means that there are adolescents being left unprotected. That means we're missing out on the best opportunity we have to prevent one or more of actually 6 different cancers. I know today we're talking about cervical cancer, but the vaccine can really, you know, help protect against 6 different cancers that are all associated with HPV. And that, you know, that totals around 32,000 cases of cancer every year.
And that includes the anal cancer, the throat.
Oropharyngeal, yep.
Yes, and those are the other ones that I really know about. What are the...
Vaginal, vulvar, and penile cancers as well, although those 3 are more rare.
Okay.
Exactly. And then also, you know, again, our focus today is on cervical cancer prevention, but the vaccine also protects against genital warts, and then it can protect against that precancer. And so that's important too, is that not only can we protect the cancer, but if we can protect the precancer, and a lot of the additional evaluation and treatment that even that women have to be put through for precancer of the cervix is important as well. And I think this is happening because more and more people are really putting in a concerted effort to get us to to higher rates of vaccination. There are individual level things like working on the education piece, but then there are systems level pieces, right? Like having clinical staff or clinic staff that are serving as vaccine champions, or leveraging our electronic health records to provide patients and clinicians support to remember to vaccinate. There's often, you know, there's text messaging and emails and phone, like various things to remind people to come back in for those subsequent doses, to complete the series.
Yes.
So there's all these, important ways to then need to continue. And I think the places that haven't really looked towards these kinds of strategies, which are all evidence-based strategies, you know, like that's where the pivot needs to happen in order to get us to that 100% vaccination rate faster.
And also that boys, young men.
Yes.
Yes. Can be vaccinated.
Exactly, right. And all of this should apply not only to the settings where girls and women are seen, but to the places where boys and young men are seen as well. Absolutely.
Which is, you know, really an incredible strategy. And I'm thinking of the commercials that, as a parent, that I see that are particularly effective, I think, And then again, knowing as a parent, when I go into a pediatrician's office, I can ask about or have different things, you know, different methods of information to help inform me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really powerful to, as a patient, feel empowered to ask about the vaccine. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that there is this like push-pull synergy that the more one recommends the vaccine and talks about it, the easier it becomes. And the more there is an interest from the patients and parents, mm-hmm. Right, the easier that it just becomes a more natural part of the care that is provided.
And being able to, but again, the disparities that we know that exist, whether, you know, it's race, socioeconomic, and being able to have those conversations, but get that information into the hands of into those communities, I should say, and into the hands of those clinicians too, who serve those populations. What are you seeing? Are you seeing any more sustained efforts to address those disparities that may exist?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting at least with adolescents, mm-hmm. When it comes to Black or Latinx adolescents, don't necessarily see a disparity in vaccination rates.
Okay,
that doesn't mean that we need to just continue offering this vaccine to all adolescents. Right. And it has. And so that's the great thing about this vaccine, is that it is actually an opportunity to close the disparities that we see on the outcome side when it comes to cervical cancer, if we do a really good job of, you know, giving, recommending and getting this vaccine to all adolescents, right. Down the road, that will hopefully help close the cancer disparity.
Yeah. And to the point, knowing that the other things, the genital warts, the precancerous lesions, all those things can be prevented too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really, really important. And what I was really interested to go to the next question, mm-hmm. that paper that you were a co-author on, the unindicated cervical cancer screening in adolescent females. Oh, why? Okay, so I found it interesting that even though cervical cancer remains very rare in adolescents, that many providers were conducting the screening. Again, like you all, you know, leading to the unnecessary biopsies, anxiety, and healthcare costs. Why was that occurring? What?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I think that there's an opportunity there based on what we found to do an even deeper dive into understanding the why. Like some of the things that we did come across is that, you know, there is misinformation or a misunderstanding of guidelines. And on some of, we were able to see when a pap was ordered in a percentage of the orders, we could see the documented indication for why it was ordered. On most of them, nothing was provided, but some of the things that were documented are not guideline based. So things such as, oh, you know, the pap was done because the patient is pregnant. The pap is done because this patient is on oral contraceptive pills. Maybe that's the proxy for meaning the patient is sexually active. And those are not indications for doing cervical cancer screening. You know, in under the age of 21,
okay.
You know, in the past, sexual activity was used to guide when to start cervical cancer screening. So those are, you know, older guidelines. And I don't know if some of it is, you know, a delay in catching up with with more current guidelines, and or if some of it is just you know, misinformation.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think comes up often is this, oh, the patient is 20 and a half and they're here today, so I'm just going to go ahead and do the PAP. And the lead author on that, Dr. Vosch, is a pediatric and adolescent gynecologist. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, she always says this very articulately that it's okay to wait until they're 21 and a half to start their screening, right? Instead of having this perspective that, oh, they're 20 and a half, so we need to do this.
Yeah.
And a nice like corollary is that we, you know, we don't say, oh, this patient is 37 weeks gestation, let's just go ahead and deliver them. We appreciate the value of the extra couple weeks, right? And it's the same thing that it's not like some switch flips and the risk like skyrockets as you approach your 21st birthday. And there's, you know, especially knowing that cervical cancers in that 21 to 24 year old age group are extraordinarily rare. And then, you know, there is a group for whom it is completely valid to do a PAP under the age of 21 if they have, you know, any sort of immunocompromised status. There's a different set of guidelines that apply to those patients. And then if a PAP does get inadvertently done in a younger adolescent, once it's done, it, you know, certainly if it's abnormal, it can't be ignored. And so then the follow-up made at that point require subsequent PAPs to be done. And those subsequent ones are not necessarily unindicated, and we did not, we didn't consider them unindicated even in our study.
It's just very, you know, it's very interesting to think about the dynamics that affect, like you said earlier, you made the comment about in healthcare in the United States, how fragmented it is, and to think about, for me at least, how that affects how certain populations are tested, what the indications are, and how that all comes about, which leads me to the next question, which is related to the pandemic.
Right.
And all the well women visits, and, you know, worrying, being concerned about how that has affected. You know, is there a concern that women will forego annual PAP and HPV tests, and if it, what you think, and then again, how practicing OBGYNs could go about addressing that?
Yeah, I mean, there are already studies within the first few months of the pandemic. There were studies coming out showing data that screening rates were going down, cancer diagnosis numbers were going down as like a measure that the reason the diagnoses are going down is because the screening and testing is not happening. And, you know, and I think it's a delicate balance, right? I think some of it is patients foregoing the testing, but, you know, clinics and practices have shifted, right? They've shifted care. So there's so much of a shift to telehealth, and
yes,
and there's a huge role for telehealth, and it is extremely important right now that, you know, we optimize telehealth, but it is going to fall short on certain things, like being able to do cervical cancer screening, being able to deliver vaccines, activities that just can't be done remotely. And there's a good reason that in many parts of the country at different times since the pandemic began, clinics have reduced their in-person volume, right? It's to keep patients safe, and it's to keep their staff safe. And it's right. So I think we need to be to like appreciate and understand that. But a consequence of the pandemic and the way that people have had to manage that risk is then this other risk potentially piling up. And, you know, in terms of what OBGYNs can do, you know, the ASCCP very early on put out a set of recommendations to guide folks in terms of what would be safe and reasonable in terms of delaying, you know, colposcopic evaluation of abnormal PAPs, for example. Like, what are those safe windows to allow? And I think those kinds of guidance are really important. And, you know, especially during a tumultuous time, mm-hmm. You know, having that kind of voice is important. And then I think, as much as possible, creating a safety net structure, right? So keeping track of who are the patients at whose appointments were canceled or postponed, yes. and having a system in which to loop them back in as soon as it's safe to do so and the in-person visits are happening again. You know, having that tracking system, like who are the patients who were due for cervical cancer screening and, you know, those didn't happen in some set of months and getting those patients back in. And then using this as an opportunity to really making sure practices are aligned with the most up-to-date guidelines. Yes. So if there are patients that don't need to come in for screening, you know, let's do that, right? De-implement the things that are no longer guidelines-based. It happens to be that multiple new guidelines have actually come out both for screening and for management of abnormal cervical cancer screening during this period of the pandemic. Yeah. And so if we can apply those, you know, and really help, you know, focus in on the patients that are most at risk, yeah. Right, we should use this opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really, really significant. And maybe what I'll do is put a list together of the links to the guidelines to accompany this.
Yeah, I think that would be great, because I think, you know, for many people, there's just so much going on that's probably gone under the radar that, you know, the American Cancer Society put out a whole new set of cancer screening guidelines, and the ASCCP put out, a whole new paradigm for managing abnormal results.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to say about this topic before we end the conversation and the interview?
I think, you know, even outside of the pandemic, I think reiterating, right, this multi-pronged approach of vaccinating, screening, and then, you know, having a smooth linkage of care for the follow-up of abnormal tests, you know, that's essentially what the global agenda for the elimination of cervical cancer has said, and you know, it applies to us as well, and really focusing on how we can work on doing those three things, you know, at a really high level.
Yes, as you said earlier, I mean, by 2035, elimination of cervical cancer, what an amazing feat.
Right. It's really exciting, and for to think like that is an achieve. You know, it will take longer than 2035 globally, but for that to even be a conversation is really exciting. Yes. And we should very much we probably won't be the first country, but to be, you know, an early country and to be really like an example for how to do that well.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your time.
And yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Pap Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.